Gordon frowned. He recognized all the voices inside as senior servants of Cyclops whom he had met, but he didn't remember being introduced to anyone named Joseph. "Joseph went to bed early, I think," Tager said. "And that's where I'm headed now. We'll discuss this again later, when we can go about it rationally." Gordon hurried down the hall as footsteps approached the door. He didn't much mind being forced to leave his eavesdropping spot. The opinions of the people in the room were of no importance anyway. No importance at all. There was only one voice he wanted to hear right now, and he headed straight to where he had listened to it last. He ducked around a corner and found himself in the elegant hallway where he had first met Herb Kahlo. The passage was dim now, but that did not keep him from picking the conference room lock with pathetic ease. Gordon's mouth was dry as he slipped into the chamber, closing the door behind him. He stepped forward, fighting the urge to walk on tiptoes. Beyond the conference table, soft light shone on the gray cylinder on the other side of the glass wall. "Please," he wished, "let me be wrong." If he was, then surely Cyclops itself would be amused by his chain of faulty deduction. How he longed to share a laugh over his foolish paranoia. He approached the great glass barrier dividing the room and the speaker at the end of the table. "Cyclops," he whispered, stepping closer, clearing his tight throat. "Cyclops, it's me, Gordon." The glow in the pearly lens was subdued, but the row of little lights still flashed, a complex pattern that repeated over and over like an urgent message from a distant ship in some lost code, ever, hypnotically, the same. Gordon felt a frantic dread rise within him, as when, during his boyhood, he had encountered his grandfather lying perfectly still on the porch swing and feared to find that the beloved old man had died. The pattern of lights repeated, over and over. Gordon wondered, how many people would recall, after the hell of the last 17 years, that the parody displays of a great computer never repeated themselves? Gordon remembered a cyberneticist friend telling him that the patterns of lights were like snowflakes, none ever the same as any other. "Cyclops," he said evenly, "answer me. I demand you answer in the name of decency, in the name of the United States." He stopped. He couldn't bring himself to meet this lie with another. Here, the only living mind he would fool would be himself. The room was warmer than it had seemed during his interview. He looked for and found the little vents through which cool air could be directed at a visitor seated in the guest chair, giving an impression of great cold just beyond the glass wall. "Dry ice," he muttered, "to fool the citizens of Oz." Dorothy herself could not have felt more betrayed. Gordon had been willing to lay down his life for what had seemed to exist here, and now he knew it was nothing but a cheat, a way for a bunch of surviving sophisticates to fleece their neighbors of food and clothing and have them be grateful for the privilege. By creating the myth of the Millennium Project and a market for salvaged electronics, they had managed to convince the locals that the old electric machines were of great value. All through the lower Willamette Valley, people now hoarded home comps, appliances, and toys because Cyclops would accept them in trade for its advice. The servants of Cyclops had arranged it so that canny people like Herb Kahlo hardly even counted the tithe of food and other goods that were added for the servants themselves. The scientists ate well, Gordon remembered, and none of the farmers ever complained. "It's not your fault," he told the silent machine softly. "You really would have designed the tools, made up for all the lost expertise, helped us find the road back. You and your kind were the greatest thing we had ever done." He choked, remembering the warm, wise voice in Minneapolis so long ago. His vision blurred and he looked down. "You are right, Gordon. It is nobody's fault." Gordon gasped. In a flash, molten hope burned that he had been mistaken. It was the voice of Cyclops. But it had not come from the speaker grill. He turned quickly and saw that a thin old man sat in the shadowed back corner of the room watching him. "I often come here, you know." The aged one spoke with the voice of Cyclops, a sad voice filled with regret. "I come to sit with the ghost of my friend, who died so long ago right here in this room." The old man leaned forward a little. Pearly light shone on his face. "My name is Joseph Lazarensky, Gordon. I built Cyclops so many years ago." He looked down at his hands. "I oversaw his programming and education. I loved him as I would my own son. And like any good father, I was proud to know that he would be a better, kinder, more human being than I had been." Lazarensky sighed. "He really did survive the onset of the war, you know. That part of the story is true. Cyclops was in his Faraday cage, safe from the battle pulses, and he remained there while we fought to keep him alive. The first and only time I ever killed a man was on the night of the anti-tech riots. I helped defend the powerhouse, shooting like somebody crazed. But it was no use. The generators were destroyed, even as the militia finally arrived to drive the mad crowds back. Too late. Minutes. Years too late." He spread his hands. "As you seem to have figured out, Gordon, there was nothing to do after that. Nothing but to sit with Cyclops and watch him die." Gordon remained very still, standing in the ghostly ash light. Lazarensky went on. "We had built up great hopes, you know. Before the riots, we had already conceived of the Millennium Plan. Or I should say, Cyclops conceived of it. He already had the outlines of a program for rebuilding the world. He needed a couple of months, he said, to work out the details." Gordon felt as if his face were made of stone. He waited silently. "Do you know anything about quantum memory bubbles, Gordon? Compared to them, Josephson junctions are made of sticks and mud. The bubbles are as light and fragile as thought. They allow mentation a million times faster than neurons, but they must be kept super cold to exist at all, and once destroyed they cannot be remade. We tried to save him. But we could not." The old man looked down again. "I would rather have died myself that night." "So you decided to carry out the plan on your own," Gordon suggested dryly. Lazarensky shook his head. "No better, of course. Without Cyclops, the task was impossible. All we could do was present a shell, an illusion. It offered a way to survive in the coming dark age. All around us was chaos and suspicion. The only leverage we poor intellectuals had was a weak, flickering thing called hope." "Hope!" Gordon laughed bitterly. Lazarensky shrugged. "Petitioners come to speak with Cyclops, and they speak with me. It isn't hard, usually, to give good advice, to look up simple techniques in books, or to mediate disputes with common sense. They believe in the impartiality of the computer, where they would never trust a living man."
"And where you can't come up with a common sense answer, you go oracular on them?"
Again the shrug. "It worked at Delphi and at Ephesus, Gordon. And honestly, where's the harm? The people of the Willamette had seen too many power-hungry monsters over the last 20 years to unite under any man or group of men. But oh, they remember the machines, as they recall that ancient uniform you wear, even though in better days they so often treated it with terrible disrespect."
There were voices in the hall. They passed close by, then faded away. Gordon stirred. "I've got to get out of here." Lazarensky laughed.
"Don't worry about the others. They're all talk and no action. They aren't like you at all."
"You don't know me," Gordon growled.
"No?
As Cyclops, I spoke with you for some hours, and both my adopted daughter and young Peter Egg have talked of you at length. I know more about you than you might imagine. You're a rarity, Gordon. Somehow, out there in the wilderness, you managed to retain a modern mind while gaining a strength suited for these times. Even if that bunch out there ever tried to harm you, you would outsmart them. Gordon moved to the door, then stopped. He turned and looked back one last time at the soft glow from the dead machine, the tiny lights rippling hopelessly over and over again. I'm not so smart. His breath was hard in his throat. You see, I believed. He met Lazarensky's eyes, and finally the old man looked down, unable to answer. Gordon stumbled out then, leaving the death-chilled crypt and its corpses behind him. 12. Oregon. He made it back to where his horse was tethered just as faint glimmers of dawn were brightening the eastern sky. He remounted, and with his heels he guided the filly up the old service road to the north. Within, he felt a hollow grief, as if a freezing cold had locked up his heart. Nothing within him could move, for fear of shattering something tottering, precarious. He had to get away from this place. That much was clear. Let the fools have their myths. He was finished. He would not return to Siotown, where he had left the mailbags. All that was behind him now. He began unbuttoning the blouse of his uniform, intending to drop it in a roadside ditch, along forever with his share in all the lying. Unbidden, a phrase echoed in his mind. Who will take responsibility now? What? He shook his head to clear it, but the words would not go away. Who will take responsibility now for these foolish children? Gordon cursed and dug in his heels. The horse gamely sped northward, away from everything he had treasured only yesterday morning, but now knew to be a Potemkin facade, a cheap, dime-store mannequin. Oz! Who will take responsibility? The words repeated over and over again within his head, firmly lodged like a tune that would not let go. It was the same rhythm, he realized at last, as the winking lights of the parody display on the face of the old dead machine, lights that had rippled again and again. For these foolish children... The filly trotted on in the dawn light past orchards bordered by rows of ruined cars, and a strange thought suddenly occurred to Gordon. What if, at the end of its life, as the last drops of liquid helium evaporated away and the deadly heat rushed in, what if the final thought of the innocent, wise machine had somehow been caught in a loop, preserved in peripheral circuits to flash forlornly over and over again? Would that qualify as a ghost? He wondered, what would Cyclops' final thoughts, its last words, have been? Can a man be haunted by the ghost of a machine? Gordon shook his head. He was tired, or else he would not think up such nonsense. He didn't owe anybody anything. Certainly not a scrap of ruined tin, or a desiccated specter found in a rusted jeep. Ghosts! He spat on the side of the road and laughed dryly. Still, the words echoed round and round inside. Who will take responsibility now? So absorbed was he that it took a few moments at first for him to recognize the faint sounds of shouting behind him. Gordon pulled up on the reins and turned to look back, his hand resting on the butt of his revolver. Anyone who pursued him now did so at great peril. Lazarensky had been right about one thing. Gordon knew he was more than a match for this bunch. In the distance, he saw there was a flurry of frantic activity in front of the house of Cyclops, but the commotion apparently did not have to do with him. Gordon shaded his eyes against the glare of the new sun and saw steam rising from a pair of heavily lathered horses. One exhausted man stumbled up the steps of the house of Cyclops, shouting at those hurrying to his side. Another messenger, apparently badly wounded, was being tended on the ground. Gordon heard one word cried out loudly. It told all.
Survivalists!
He had one word to offer in reply.
Shit!
He turned his back on the noises and snapped the reins, sending the filly northward once again. A day ago he would have helped. He'd been willing to lay down his life trying to save Cyclops' dream, and probably would have done just that. He would have died for a hollow farce, a ruse, a con game. If the Holnest invasion had really begun, the villagers south of Eugene would put up a good fight. The raiders would turn north toward the front of least resistance. The soft North Willamators didn't stand a chance against the Rogue River men. Still, there probably weren't enough Holnests to take the entire valley. Corvallis would fall, certainly, but there would be other places to go. Perhaps he might head east on Highway 22 and swing back around to Pine View. It would be nice to see Mrs. Thompson again. Maybe he could be there when Abby's baby arrived. The filly trotted on. The shouts died away behind him like a bad memory slowly fading. It promised to be fair weather, the first in weeks without clouds, a good day for traveling. As Gordon rode on, a cool breeze blew through his half-open shirt front. 100 yards down the road, he found his hand drifting to the buttons again, twisting one slowly, back and forth. The pony sauntered, slowed, and came to a halt. Gordon sat, his shoulders hunched forward.
Who will take responsibility?
The words would not go away, lights pulsing in his mind. The horse tossed her head and snorted, pawing at the ground.
Who?
Gordon cried out,
Hell!
He wheeled the filly about, sending her cantering southward again. A babbling, frightened crowd of men and women stepped back in hushed silence as he clattered up to the portico of the House of Cyclops. His spirited mount danced and blew as he stared down at the people for a long, silent moment. Finally, Gordon threw his poncho back. He rebuttoned his shirt and set the postman's cap on his head so the bright brass rider shone in the light of the rising sun. He took a deep breath. Then he began pointing, giving terse commands. In the name of survival, and in the name of the restored United States, the people of Corvallis and the servants of Cyclops all hurried to obey. Interlude. High above gray, foam-flecked wave tops, the jet stream throbbed. Winter had come again, and winds moaned chill recollections over the North Pacific. Fewer than 20 cycles passed, the normal patterns of the air had been perturbed by great, dark funnels, as if armies of angry volcanoes had chosen the same moment to throw earth against sky. If the episode had not ended quickly, perhaps all life might have vanished, and the ice returned forever. Even as it was, clouds of ash had blanketed the earth for weeks before the larger grains fell out of the sky like dirty rain. Smaller bits of rock and soot dispersed into the high stratospheric streams, scattering the sunlight. Years passed before spring came again. At last, it did come. The ocean, slow, resilient, surrendered up just enough heat to stop the spiral short of no return. In time, warm, sea-drenched clouds again swept over the continent. The tall trees grew, and weeds sprouted earnestly, unmolested, through cracks in broken pavement. Still, there remained plenty of dust, riding the high winds. Now and then the cold air ventured south again, carrying reminders of the long chill. Vapor crystallized around the grains, forming complex, fractal hexahedrons. Snowflakes grew and fell. Obstinate, winter arrived one more time to claim a dark country. Part 3. Cincinnatus. 1. Gusts sculpted whirling devil shapes in the blowing snow. Flurries that seemed to rise ghost-like from the gray drifts, fluttering and darting wind-blown under the frosted trees. A heavily laden branch cracked, unable to bear the weight of one more dingy snowflake. The report echoed like a muffled gunshot down the forest's narrow lanes. Snow delicately covered the death-glazed eyes of a starved deer, filling the channels between its starkly outlined ribs. Flakes soon hid faint grooves in the icy ground where the animal had last pawed, only hours ago in its fruitless search for food. Taking no sides, the dancing flurries went on to cloak other victims as well, settling soft, white layers over crimson stains in the crushed, older snow. All the corpses soon lay blanketed, peaceful, as if asleep. The new storm had erased most signs of the struggle by the time Gordon found Tracy's body under the dark shadow of a winter-whitened cedar. By then, a frozen crust had staunched the bleeding. Nothing more flowed from the unlucky young woman's slashed throat. Gordon pushed away thoughts of Tracy as he had briefly known her in life, ever cheerful and brave, with a slightly mad enthusiasm for the hopeless job she had taken on. His lips pressed together grimly as he tore open her woolen shirt and reached in to feel under her armpit. The body was still warm. This had not happened long ago. Gordon squinted to the southwest, where tracks, already fading under the blowing snow, led off into the painful ice brightness. In a flat, almost silent movement, a white-clad shape appeared beside him.
"Damn," he heard Philip Bokuto whisper. "Tracy was good. I could have sworn those pricks wouldn't have been able to..."
"Well, they did," Gordon cut him off sharply. "And it wasn't more than 10 minutes ago."
Taking the girl's belt buckle, he heaved her over to show the other man. The dark, brown face under the white parka nodded silently, understanding. Tracy had not been molested, or even mutilated with Holiness symbols. This small band of hyper-survivalists had been in too much of a hurry even to stop and take their customary, grisly trophies.
"We can catch him,"
Bokuto whispered. Anger burned in his eyes.
"I can fetch the rest of the patrol and be back here in 3 minutes."
Gordon shook his head. "No, Phil. We've already chased them too far beyond our defense perimeter. They'll have an ambush set by the time we get close. We'd better just collect Tracy's body and go home now."
Bokuto's jaw clenched, a bunching of tendons. For the first time, his voice rose above a whisper.
"We can catch the bastards!"
Gordon felt a wave of irritation.
"What right does Philip have to do this to me?"
Bokuto had once been a sergeant in the Marines, before the world fell to ruin nearly 2 decades ago. It should have been his job, not Gordon's, to make the practical, unsatisfying decisions, to be the one responsible. He shook his head.
"No, we will not, and that's final."
He looked down at the girl. Until this afternoon, the second best scout in the Army of the Willamette, but apparently not quite good enough. "We need living fighters, Phil. We need fierce men, not more corpses." For a silent moment, neither looked at the other. Then Bokuto pushed Gordon to one side and stepped over the still form on the snow.
"Give me 5 minutes before you bring up the rest of the patrol," he told Gordon as he dragged Tracy's body into the leeward shadow of the cedar and drew his knife.
"You're right, sir. We need angry men. Tracy and I'll see to it that's what you get."
Gordon blinked.
"Phil!"
He reached forward.
"Don't!"
Bokuto ignored Gordon's hand as he grimaced and tore Tracy's shirt open wider. He did not look up, but his voice was broken.
I said, you're right. We had to make our cow-eyed farmers mad enough to fight, and this is one of the ways Dina and Tracy told us to use if we had to.
Gordon could hardly believe this.
Dina's crazy, Phil. Haven't you realized that by now? Please, don't do this.
He grabbed the man's arm and pulled him around, but then had to step back from the threatening glitter of Bakuto's knife. His friend's eyes were hot and agonized as he waved Gordon away.
Don't make this harder for me, Gordon. You're my commander, and I'll serve you so long as it's the best way to kill as many of those Holiness bastards as possible. But, Gordon, you get so friggin' civilized at the worst of times. That's when I draw the line. Do you hear me? I won't let you betray Tracy, or Dina, or me with your fits of 20th century sappiness. Now get out of here, Mr. Inspector. Sir.
Bakuto's voice was thick with emotion.
Then remember to give me 5 minutes before you bring up the others.
He glowered until Gordon had backed away. Then he spat on the ground, wiped one eye, and bent back to the grisly task awaiting him. At first, Gordon stumbled, half stunned, as he retreated down the gray-sided meadow. Phil Bakuto had never turned on him that way before, waving a knife, wild-eyed, disobeying orders. Then Gordon remembered. I never actually commanded him not to do this, did I? I asked. I pleaded. But I didn't order him. Am I completely sure he isn't right at that? Do even I, deep inside, believe some of those things Dina and her band of lunatic women are preaching? Gordon shook his head. Phil was certainly right about one thing. The stupidity of philosophizing on a battlefield. Out here, survival was enough of a problem. That other war, the one he had been waging each night in his dreams, would have to wait its turn. He made his way downslope carefully, clutching his drawn bayonet, the most practical weapon for this kind of weather. Half his men had put aside their rifles and bows for long knives, another trick painfully learned from their deadly, devious enemy. He and Bakuto had left the rest of the patrol only 50 meters back, but it felt like much more as his eyes darted in search of traps. The whirling snow devil seemed to take on forms, like the vaporous scouts of a hairy army that had not yet taken sides, ethereal neutrals in a quiet, deadly war.
Who will take responsibility?
They seemed to whisper at him. The words had never left Gordon, not since that fateful morning when he had chosen between practicality and a doomed charade of hope. At least, this particular raiding party of Holan survivalists had fared worse than usual, and the local farmers and villagers had done better than anyone would have expected. Also, Gordon and his escort party had been on an inspection tour nearby. They had been able to join the fray at a critical moment. In essence, his army of the Willamette had won a minor victory, losing only 20 or so men to 5 of the enemy. There were probably no more than 3 or 4 of this Holiness band left to flee westward. Still, 4 of those human monsters were more than enough, even tired and short on ammunition. His patrol only numbered 7 now, and help was far away.
Let them go. They'll be back.
The hoot of a horned owl warbled just ahead of him. He recognized Leif Morrison's challenge.
He's getting better. If we're still alive in a year, it might even sound real enough to fool someone.
He pursed his lips and tried to mimic the call. 2 hoots in answer to Morrison's 3. Then he dashed across a narrow glade and slid into the gully where the patrol waited. Morrison and 2 other men gathered close. Their beards and sheepskin cloaks were coated with dry snow, and they fingered their weapons nervously.
Joe and Andy? Gordon asked.
Leif, the big Swede, nodded left and right.
Pickets,
he said tersely. Gordon nodded.
Good.
Under the big spruce, he untied his pack and pulled out a thermos bottle, one of the privileges of rank. He didn't have to ask permission to pour himself a cup of hot cider. The others took their positions again, but kept glancing back, obviously wondering what the inspector was up to this time. Morrison, a farmer who had barely escaped the rape of Greenleaf Town last September, eyed him with the simmering look of a man who had lost everything he loved, and was therefore no longer entirely of this world. Gordon glanced at his watch. A beautiful pre-war chronometer provided by the technicians of Corvallis. Bokuto had had enough time. By now he would be circling back, covering his tracks.
"Tracy's dead," he told the others. Their faces blanched.
Gordon went on, weighing their reactions.
"I guess she was trying to cut around past the bastards and hold them for us. She didn't ask my permission."
He shrugged. "They got her." The stunned expressions turned into a round of seething, guttural curses.
"Better. But the wholeness won't wait for you to remember to get mad next time, boys. They'll kill you while you're still deciding whether or not to be scared."
Well practiced by now at the art of lying, Gordon continued in a flat tone. "5 minutes quicker and we might have saved her. As it is, they had time to take souvenirs." This time, anger battled revulsion on their faces, and burning shame overcame both.
"Let's go after them," Morrison urged. "They can't be far ahead."
The others muttered agreement.
"Not quickly enough," Gordon judged.
"No. If you boys were sluggish getting here, you're much too slow to deal with the inevitable ambush. We'll move up in skirmish line and retrieve Tracy's body, then we're going home."
One of the farmers, among the loudest demanding pursuit, showed immediate relief.
The others, though, glared back at Gordon, hating him for his words.
"Stand in line, boys.
If I were a real leader of men, I'd have found a better way to put backbone into you than this." He put away his thermos, not offering any cider to the others. The implication was clear, that they didn't deserve any.
"Hop to it," he said, as he slung his light pack over his shoulders.
They did move quickly this time, gathering their gear and scrambling out across the snow. Over to the left and right, he saw Joe and Andy emerge from cover and take their places on the flanks. Holmists would never have been so visible, of course, but then they had had a lot more practice than these reluctant soldiers. Those with unlimbered rifles covered the knife men who dashed ahead. Gordon easily kept up, just behind the skirmish line. In a minute, he felt Bokuto fall in beside him, appearing as if out of nowhere from behind a tree. For all of their earnestness, none of the farmers had spotted him. The scout's expression was blank, but Gordon knew what he was feeling. He did not meet Bokuto's eyes. Ahead, there came a sudden, angry exclamation. The lead man must have come upon Tracy's mutilated body.
"Imagine how they'd feel if they ever found out the truth about that," Philip told Gordon softly. "Or if they ever discovered the real reason why most of your scouts are girls."
Gordon shrugged. It had been a woman's idea, but he had agreed to it. The guilt was his alone. So much guilt in a cause he knew was hopeless. And yet he could not let even the cynical Bokuto sense the full extent of the truth. For his sake, Gordon maintained a front.
"You know the main reason," he told his aide. "Underneath Dina's theories and the promise of Cyclops, beneath it all, you know what it's for."
Bokuto nodded, and for a brief moment, there was something else in his voice.
"For the restored United States," he said softly, almost reverently. "Lies within lies. If you ever found out the truth, my friend."
"For the restored United States," he agreed aloud.
"Yeah."
Together, they moved ahead to watch over their army of frightened, but now angry, men. 2. "It's no good, Cyclops." Beyond the thick pane of glass, a pearly, opalescent eye stared back at him from a tall cylinder swaddled in cool fog. A double row of tiny, flickering lights rippled a complex pattern over and over again. This was Gordon's ghost, the specter that had haunted him for months now, the only lie he had ever met to match his own damnable fraud. It felt proper to do his thinking here in this darkened room. Out in the snows, on village stockades, in the lonely, dim forests, men and women were dying for the two of them, for what he, Gordon, supposedly represented, and for the machine on the other side of the glass. For Cyclops, and for the restored United States. Without those twin pillars of hope, the Willamettas might well have collapsed by now. Corvallis would lie in ruins, its hoarded libraries, its fragile industry, its windmills and flickering electric lights all vanished forever into the lowering dark age. The invaders from the Rogue River would have established fiefdoms up and down the valley, as they had done already in the area west of Eugene. The farmers and aged Tex were battling an enemy 10 times more experienced and capable, but they fought anyway, not so much for themselves as for 2 symbols, for a gentle, wise machine that had really died many years ago, and for a long-vanished nation that existed now only in their imaginations. The poor fools. "It isn't working," Gordon told his peer, his fellow hoax. The row of lights replied by dancing the same complex pattern that burned in his dreams. "This heavy winter has stopped the Holnists for now. They're kicking back in the towns they captured last autumn. But come springtime, they'll be back again, picking away at us, burning and killing until, one by one, the villages sue for protection. We try to fight, but each of those devils is a match for 12 of our poor townsmen and farmers." Gordon slumped in a soft chair across from the thick sheet of glass. Even here, in the house of Cyclops, the smell of dust and age was heavy. "If we had time to train, to prepare, if only things had not been so peaceful here for so long, if only we had a real leader, someone like George Powhatan." Through the closed doors he could hear faint music. Somewhere in the building there lifted the light, moving strains of Pachelbel's canon, a 20-year-old recording playing on a stereo. He remembered weeping when he had first heard such music again. He had been so eager to think something brave and noble still existed in the world, so willing to believe he had found it here in Corvallis. But Cyclops turned out to be a hoax, much like his own myth of a restored United States. It still puzzled him that both fables thrived more than ever in the shadow of the survivalist invasion. They had grown amid the blood and terror into a something for which people were daily giving their lives. "It's just not working," he told the ruined machine again, not expecting an answer. "Our people fight, they die. But the camouflage bastards will be here by summer no matter what we do." He listened to the sweet, sad music and wondered if, after Corvallis fell, anyone, anywhere would listen to Pachelbel ever again. There was a faint tapping on the double door behind him. Gordon sat up. Other than himself, only the servants of Cyclops were allowed in this building at night.
"Yes,"
he said. A narrow trapezoid of light spilled in. The shadow of a tall, long-haired woman stretched across the carpeted floor. Dina, if there was anyone he did not want to see right now. Her voice was low, quick. "I'm sorry to disturb you, Gordon, but I thought you'd want to know at once. Johnny Stevens just rode in." Gordon stood up, his pulse rising. "My God, he got through!" Dina nodded. "There was some trouble, but Johnny did get to Roseburg and back."
"Men! Did he bring—"
He stopped, seeing her shake her head. Hope crashed in the look in her eyes.
"Dan,"
she said. Gordon, he carried your message to the Southerners, and they sent 10 men. Strangely, her voice seemed to carry less dread than shame, as if everyone had let him down somehow. Then something happened that he had never witnessed before. Her voice broke.
Oh, Gordon, they aren't even men. They're boys. Only boys.
3. Dina had been taken in as a toddler by Joseph Lazarensky and the other surviving Corvallis techs soon after the Doom War, and was raised among the servants of Cyclops. Because of this, she had grown tall for a woman of these times, and was far better educated. It was one reason he had been first attracted to her. Lately, though, Gordon found himself wishing she had read fewer books, or an awful lot more. She had developed a fury. Worse, she was almost fanatical about it, spreading it among her own coterie of impressionable young women, and beyond. Gordon was afraid that, inadvertently, he had played a role in this process. He was still unsure just why he had let Dina talk him into letting some of her girls join the army as scouts.
Young Tracy Smith's body sprawled upon the wind-blown drifts, tracks leading off into the blinding snow.
Wrapped in winter coats, he and Dina walked past the men guarding the entrance of the House of Cyclops and stepped outside into the bitterly clear night. Dina said softly,
"If Johnny really has failed, it means we have only one chance left, Gordon."
"I don't want to talk about it." He shook his head. "Not now." It was cold, and he was in a hurry to get to the refectory to hear the Stevens lads' report. Dina grabbed his arm tightly and held on until he looked at her.
"Gordon, you've got to believe that nobody's more disappointed about this than I am. Do you think my girls and I wanted Johnny to fail? Do you think we're that crazy?"
Gordon refrained from answering on first impulse. Earlier in the day he had passed the cluster of those recruits of Dina's, young women from villages all over the northern Willamette Valley. Girls with passionate voices and the fervid eyes of converts. They had been a strange sight, dressed in the buckskin of army scouts with knives sheathed at hip, wrist, and ankle, sitting in a circle with books open on their laps.
No, Maria, you've got it mixed up. Lysistrata isn't anything at all like the story of the Danaids. They were both wrong, but for different reasons. Oh, I don't get it. Because one group used sex and the other used swords? No, that's not it. It's because both groups lacked a vision, an ideology.
The argument had halted abruptly when the women caught sight of Gordon. They scrambled to their feet, saluted, and watched him as he hurried uncomfortably by. All of them had that strange, shining expression in their eyes, something that made him feel they were observing him as a prime specimen, a symbol, but of what he could not tell. Tracy had had that look. Whatever it meant, he didn't want any part of it. Gordon felt badly enough about men dying for his lies, but these women... No. He shook his head as he answered Dina. "No, I don't think you're that crazy." She laughed and squeezed his arm.
"Good. I'll settle for that much, for now."
He knew, though, that that would not be the end of it. Inside the refectory, another guard took their coats. Dina at least had the wisdom to hang back then, as Gordon went on alone to hear the bad news. Youth was a wonderful thing. Gordon remembered when he had been a teenager, just before the Doom War. Back then, nothing short of a car wreck could have slowed him down. Worse things had happened to some of the boys who had left Southern Oregon with Johnny Stevens, nearly 2 weeks ago. Johnny himself must have been through hell.